Hello, and welcome once again to the Oklahoma Atheist Godcast, a digital audio stream in which the members of the AOK are casting gods out, broadcasting our doubt, and casting about for answers to difficult questions. Today on the show is part one. Eric and I will be interviewing John Loftus. John Loftus holds several master's degrees in the area of philosophy of religion and majored under William Lane Craig, earning a Master's of Theology at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in 1985. He is the founder of the Debunking Christianity blog and the author of Why I Became an Atheist and editor of The Christian Delusion. We'll put all those links on the blog for you. blog.oklahomaatheists.com. Enjoy the show. We're here with John Loftus, and we're going to be discussing the Outsider Test for Faith, right?
Yes.
Cool, I don't care.
All right. So, I guess, give us a little background first. You did not come from a skeptical household to begin with, right?
No, I didn't. I was raised by a father who was raised by a father who was raised by a father who came from Northern Ireland, and we were all Irish Catholics, dyed in the wool. My great grandfather Thomas Loftus came to the States, and he was born in the States. His parents came to the States, and at the time the Catholics were persecuted in the East Coast, so 96% of them of the people in Dubuque, Iowa were Catholics because they found that to be a safe place for themselves. And so then it was just Catholic through and through. And when they moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana, they brought their Catholicism, of course, with them. I was raised Catholic. I heard all the stories. Went through parochial school, and I never heard of a skeptic. I never talked to in my life believed at least some kind of thing, you know, about Jesus. And the stories apparently were all true. And there just wasn't any doubt in my life, except that I went through a usual teenage rebellion. I just did. And then when I came upon some hard times, I didn't know where else to turn to but that faith that was inculcated within me. Yeah, I there were times in my life back, say, 17, 18 years old, 19 years old, when I just did not have a doubt at all. I would hitchhike for the express purpose of witnessing, and sometimes I would be effective, and we'd stop at some church, and I'd baptize them. You know, these are people that picked me up hitchhiking, and I went out to...
Oh, my God, city. Wow.
Yeah, and I would go to the Memorial Coliseum after a hockey game with some friends, and we would park our car there, and we'd talk to people who were coming out from the hockey games. Went to Johnny Appleseed Park there, and on July 4th, just before the fireworks, we'd hand out flyers and brochures, and we went down to strip joints down in the heart of Fort Wayne, and witness to the patrons. You can imagine that. You can imagine that. Get right with Jesus, you sinner, you whore dog.
I bet they love that. Yeah.
Yeah, you would think that the strip joint owners, the Cat's Meow and some other places down there, Toulouse's, it was a gay bar, you would think that they would want to get rid of us. Bad for business, you know. But we flocked out there Friday and Saturday night.
Were you an evangelical Catholic what kind of Christian were you at that point?
Oh, yeah, I might have been a little bit confusing. I had a Protestant evangelical conversion at the age of about 17. You know, I was raised I was raised a Catholic, right? But I never found anything within Catholicism, you know, at that point in my life that was too exciting. The Jesus movement, came through Fort Wayne, you know, in the early 70s, and we wore bell bottom jeans, and we had phrases like "get high on Jesus" and stuff like that, and it was quite a communal type thing for some of us.
Right on, right on. I've been around
the Jesus People USA. I have some sense of the whole hippie Jesus lifestyle.
Oh, yeah. California, too.
Yeah.
Right. About 68, 69 into 73, somewhere right around that area, you know, just, you know, I mean, the Woodstock generation, you know, I mean, it seems like Christians and churches, they seem to follow the cultural trends. And so you had the hate Ashbury scene, the drugs, and you had the Woodstock people. And, well, you know, in order to reach these younger people, we've got to tailor our message to the younger people. And, you know, we ate it up. You know, we didn't know what was going on, but the churches did, the Christians did. And they reached us with the same kind of cultural hype that was in the air. And they just, you know, put the word Jesus in there. Right. You know, we sit around with our legs crossed and, you know, waving our hands and, you know, long hair and listening to drums, you know, like we had some budding Christian rock bands, like, I don't know, Chuck Gerrard and Larry Norman and, you know, Petra, and
Petra. I love them.
Sure, sure. they mimicked the rock music of the day. Yeah, Petra came from my era.
I've never heard these.
I'm talking
bands.
About Petra back when they still had Greg X. Foltz as their lead singer. Not, you know, after that they kind of went downhill.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah.
Little inside Christian rock there. That's probably not appropriate for an atheist podcast.
And I'm on the outside. I have no idea what you guys
are talking
about. You're
like the outsider test for Christian rock.
Yeah. When you guys are talking about, you know, the Christian music bands and everything, it kind of reminds me of that South Park episode where Cartman just basically takes a bunch of love songs and replaces the word baby with the word Jesus.
That's all
and,
you have to do.
Yeah.
I just want to be inside you, Jesus.
it works surprisingly well.
Usually.
That's the freaky thing about it.
Cartman, I'm afraid you're actually in love with Jesus. Okay, so what happened after that? How'd you go from being a hitchhiking street preacher to where you are now?
Well, you know, I just, you know, I was education. I mean, I was educated. I mean, in the ways of the world as well as, you know, in studying the Bible. And as being a pastor, I think that just to speak to the pastor, you know, the preacher issue. You know, I think one way to destroy your faith is to become a pastor. I think everybody ought to become a pastor. I mean, I really do. I think that you know, you want to see what really goes on in a church, yeah, become a preacher. You know, go ahead, just I dare you. You know, you can stay on the outskirts and all you want. You come to church and you hear the great music and you see hear the testimonies and what have you, and the good motivational sermons, but you don't really know what goes on in the backwoods, you know, I mean, the back rooms there, and the people who actually run the church, and how they manipulate things, and how they throw their weight around, and how much money is important, you know, to the running of the church, but yeah, be a preacher, I dare you.
I'm pretty sure that would ruin my career as an atheist organizer. I would screw up.
Yeah.
I got certified online, one of those...
Life Church? Life Church?
Universal Life Church. I got certified as a preacher on there, so...
Yeah, I did that too. And then I married people, I hope it counts. Okay, so...
And then education, I mean, everything I experienced and everything I learned... eventually ended my faith. I mean, you know, I mean, you're talking about answers to prayer, you're talking about lifestyle, you're talking about, you know, a God who threatens you with hell, you know, if you have doubts. You know, you're talking about the historical reliability of the Bible and its claims, and when compared to other ancient myths, and you're supposed to say, well, no, these really happened, but those didn't, you know, and,
right.
You know, on and on. I mean, just before you know it, you just couldn't believe it anymore. I mean, just a massive impact of all kinds of data just assailed me.
So you studied under the famed Christian apologist, Bill Craig, is that right?
I did. At the time I studied with him, I didn't. I mean, he wasn't famous. He was a well-known scholar. I mean, a budding, upcoming scholar. You know, when I studied with him at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, graduated in the 85, I think, and I took half of my hours with him in the Master of Theology program, and you know, I mean, no, we didn't have any clue that he was going to be as famous as he ended up being with his arguments and his debates, mostly probably from his debates. He would come into class and he would talk about someone he debated. So back in the 80s, early 80s, 82, 83, 84, he was already debating. So just think how many debates, you know, if he were to add them up, it'd be, you know, certainly over 1,000, maybe upwards of 2,000. You know, I would like to know that. I don't know for sure. But he was a high school debater, you know, so he's, all his life he's done debating. So he's probably become known for that, because there are a lot of scholars out there who have written a lot of items and, you know, and he has his own body of work, no doubt. But, you know, anyway, coupled with his debates, yeah, he's quite famous.
So how long after that, after getting your master's in theology, did you start to seriously question whether your faith is true?
Probably 6 years later, you know. And I have to stress, you know, this. You know, there are a lot of people who disagree with their professors. William Lane Craig was a student of John Hick, probably arguably one of the greater philosophers of religion of the last half of the last century, you know. And, you know, John Hick's a liberal, and, of course, Bill isn't. So, you know, just because people disagree with professors, I mean, it's, you know, I don't mean to make that, make light of the fact, you know, people just disagree that, you know, that's all there is to it. I don't think I'll ever convince him, you know, otherwise, and, you know, if I could, I would, but, you know, people have person-related reasons for believing in a lot of different things, you know, and, you know, I think I have good, solid reasons for denying what he affirms.
Right. So, yeah, let's get into the outsider test. I take it you were taking an insider test when you were doing it. You were.
Yeah, I mean, let's describe an insider viewpoint as someone who is born and raised inside a viewpoint, you know, and people all over the world are raised inside certain cultural beliefs, certain religious faiths, and so I was. I mean, I was never forced to be skeptical. You know, I've never met a skeptical person, you know, for, you know, I don't know how long. I think the first skeptical person that I knew was a skeptical person was probably Anthony Flew at the Bowling Green University, I think. He debated Richard Swinburne, and he was really an anomaly to me, just to look upon him and say, wow, he doesn't believe. You know, that's how naive, you know, you're cloistered inside the walls of a church-oriented mind, and, you know, and so that's all you know, that's all you think. And so, yeah, an insider perspective, then, is one, oh, I suppose, could be described as somebody raised in a polygamist family, or, you know, a militant Muslim family, you know, that's all you know, a Mormon family, a snake handlers family, you know, just that's all you know. So, or even homeschooling, you know, if you want to gear a child towards a particular orientation, you know, of some kind, and you just homeschool them, you know, so that's all you know. And they can teach you things like the outsiders are bad, you know, watch them, you know, like, I was raised a Catholic. Well, we had parochial school, where we had to study the Catholic doctrines, and they would say, now, they would tell us about the skeptics. They would tell us about people who didn't believe. I mean, they wouldn't, I don't know that they called them skeptics, just people who don't believe like us. They would say, now, we're going to warn you, you know, there are people out there who don't agree with us, and you have to be on guard against them, and you have to be careful not to just believe what they have to say, because the church teaches what's true, you see. So as a kid, you're already on guard against that stuff. And that's an insider's perspective. And even from an insider's perspective, even though I was grown up with a particular faith and adopted the, you know, the evangelicalism, even from that perspective, even from the perspective of faith, wanting my faith to be true, defending it, you know, I still couldn't end up believing it. I mean, so yeah, it fails the insider test, but it doesn't fail the insider test for most people.
Right, only if you spend years and years studying it and trying to make it all fit together, which most people don't have time to do, don't have the inclination to do.
Most people really don't know all that much about religion in general. I mean, that latest study itself, the latest prayer study by the Pew Institute,
yeah,
or something.
Religion and Public Life, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They, basically, the one thing I can really take away from that is that people in general don't really know that much about religion.
Yeah, so, which makes it easier to keep believing.
Yeah.
But atheists do. A recent poll, I think it was a Pew study, says atheists know more about religion than people who have a religious faith. Did you see that?
Well, yeah, that's true. It's actually more religion in general. But when it came to Christianity specifically, technically atheists came in third, but nonetheless, still, I mean,
Mormons are right up there.
Mormons were number one. Yeah. Evangelical Christians came in number two, atheists three, and I think Jews four. But the thing that amazed me, though, is that these questions were incredibly easy.
Yeah.
And the idea
were,
that
like,
any...
Who is Maimonides? No, not who is he, but what religion was he?
Like, yeah. Or things like, what was the first book of the Bible? Name the four Gospels, that kind
Lord.
Of thing. And the fact that there were actually people who didn't get that right, the evangelicals or any Christian that didn't get that right, amazes me. I can understand an atheist who wasn't, you know, born and raised Christian or something like that, who doesn't have any experience with Christianity, possibly getting that wrong, but a Christian not knowing the four Gospels just amazes me.
Yeah. Well, you're right. I mean, I meet a lot of people playing pool, and, you know, if you ever talk with them, I mean, yeah, you know, they believe in God, you know, and to find out that I don't, oh, that's bad news, you see, and... you know, the God they believe, of course, is a Christian God, but they don't know anything about their faith. Not at all. I mean, in fact, you know, I'm sure evangelicals would, I'm sure they'd say, well, they're not really Christians. You know, they don't really believe. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the bar in the first place, for instance, or something like that, you know. These people, they just, you know, they were raised as Christians, and, you know, they don't go to church now, but they still believe, and you don't have to go to church to believe, and they know nothing about the Christian faith, you know, but they just on polls, you know, they'll always say, yeah, we're Christians.
Yeah, like this, I just pulled up the study right here, and what's amazing to me is that they asked how many of these Christians know the four Gospels. For white evangelicals, only 71% could name all four Gospels.
Wow. So they're not even taking the insider test. They're not even really even
the
studying.
The white mainline Protestant, only 43%. That's
wow.
But less than half of the mainline Protestants interviewed didn't even know the four Gospels.
So, I mean, I guess the lesson there is people aren't really trying to take to learn the facts of their faith and trying to incorporate it all into a coherent worldview. They're just kind of, I don't know, going to work or going to pool tournaments or whatever they do, and
they're not
fretting about getting all their theology straight. It's not a big thing for them.
But yet they think it's amazing people don't believe it, which.
Yeah, it's easy faith. You know, you don't have to do much. You just, it's a rabbit's foot in your pocket. What's damaging, though, is that these people who have that kind of faith and claim to be evangelicals, who don't know much about the Bible or theology, or probably don't even get involved much with the church at all, whenever it comes to polls, they say, yeah, we're Christians, so, you know, or, yeah, we're evangelicals, and evangelicals, they love to see those numbers, even though they themselves would not really embrace the percentages of these people who claim to be evangelicals. They just use these in the polls to bolster their numbers.
Yeah. So the outsider test for faith, if somebody said, how could I take... Yeah, I guess we should start with why. Why should you take the outsider test?
Oh, it's because that's how you evaluate all the other religions. You know, I mean, what do Christians think of when they are faced with the Mormon beliefs, for instance? Oh, I don't think so. You know, or basically, show me why they're wrong. You know, they're skeptical. They just don't. They can't believe it. No, that sounds so weird. Jesus visiting, you know, America and these golden tablets and. And didn't I hear somewhere that someone said that they even though at one time they said that they saw these golden tablets, then later on they recanted and said nah. So they'll believe whatever it takes to maintain their insider perspective while denying the possibility of the outsider faith, the new faith, the one that is being presented to them. And so that's how they do, that's how they examine all the other religions, you know, except their own, because they were raised in it. And, well, you know, I just ask them the simple questions like, you know, how do we get our faith in the first place? Well, you know, it's quite obvious that we get them because we were indoctrinated from a youth, from our youth, and whether it's our parents or, you know, a small select group of people we hang around with, or children, or parochial school, or, you know, even in our culture, we see it everywhere, you know, and, you know, you go to weddings, well, where do you go? You go to church. You go to funerals. Well, who do you hear? Well, you hear a preacher. You know, our cemeteries have crosses, you know, in them, you know, I mean, on and on. I mean, our names, John, James, and Peter, and Paul, I mean, that's changing more and more. We're becoming more and more pluralistic, which I'm grateful for. But, you know, all these sorts of things, all these sorts of things are Christian-oriented. So we adopt them, and I'm just saying, now that you're an adult, you know, now that you're, I don't care how old you are, you know, whatever you want to define an adult as, you know, you want to be a thinking person for yourself now. Now that you were raised on your mama's knees to believe a certain religion, now it's time to think about it. You know, you were taught to accept Santa Claus, and you did until mom and dad said no, we were just, you know, pretending, you know. Well, the reason why you don't come away thinking that your religion is a pretend game is because they, your parents, never told you that that's a pretend game too, because their parents never told them that was a pretend game. And so now let's think about it. How can all of these moms and dads be correct who raise their kids, you know, thinking different religion after another is correct? And I'm just saying, you know, you ought to approach them skeptically, because they, simply because it's, you know, a truism, they can't all be true. And so you need to be skeptical of the religion you were raised with, simply because you're skeptical about the other religions. And let's just see if if you are skeptical about it, let's just see if, you know, you can come to believe it after you examine it, you know, like that. I mean, we should be skeptical of extraordinary claims. We should be skeptical of a con man. We should be skeptical of claims proportionate to the kind of claim it is. And right. Since these are extraordinary claims about virgin births and resurrections and you know, axe heads that float, and women who are turned into pillars of salt and fire that comes down from the sky, and et cetera, et cetera. Examine that a bit more skeptically.
So is it sort of like a golden rule, like you should do unto your own belief system that you were raised with as you do unto others' belief systems that they were raised with?
Exactly, sure. I would think so. I mean, that's a quote from James McGrath, and I appreciate what he had said there. I mean, yeah, if you want to really honor the golden rule, which isn't necessarily Christian in origin, but it's still a good rule, all things considered, if you want to really treat, you know, the religions the same as you treat your own, and then you ought to treat them all skeptically. You ought to take your thumb off the weighing scales, the thumb of faith. Because you got your thumb there, and you treat other religions differently. You treat yours with faith, and you treat theirs with skepticism. Why can't you just treat them all the same and see what it gives? Now, here's the thing. If God exists, then he should have made the Christian faith pass the outsider test for faith, and that's because there are a lot of people born around the globe who were brought up differently. I mean, they were brought up in a different culture with a different religion. So if Christianity does not pass the outsider test for faith, then ipso facto, these people who are raised around the globe with different religions could never be saved, because unless Christianity passes the outsider test for faith, then they could never become Christians. it has to convince people of different religions and different cultures. That means passing the outsider test for faith, because the people in these other cultures with different religions are outsiders to Christianity.
You know, that actually reminds me of a conversation we had at the Texas Freethought Convention. We talked about something about how, you know, pretty much on the lines of what you said, that if God really wanted to save you and God knows exactly what it would take to convince you, then why wouldn't he do it? And then I remember you pointed out something that actually, it really struck me as amazing, that I guess somebody on one of your boards had posted that if God really wanted you to believe, why wouldn't he just, you know, if rationality was in the way, wouldn't he just, you know, kind of take away your rationality? I always thought that was amazing.
Or just provide rational evidence.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, God, I mean, there's two different ways he could do that. He could either provide the evidence that would convince me to believe, or he could just snap his fingers and take away my rational thinking capabilities, the ones that demand evidence, and so then I would become a gullible person, and I would believe. I mean, he could do any of that. Now, people say, well, isn't that taking away free will? Isn't that taking away free choice? Well, if it does, then he did that with Abraham and Moses and Gideon and St. Paul on the Damascus Road. I mean, all of them he appeared to, all of them he showed convincing proofs by saying to Moses, put your hand inside your cloak, it becomes leprous, put it back in, it's normal again. Well, why didn't he do that to us? It's Saul. Apparently he saw Jesus on Damascus Road. Well, if that doesn't take away his free will, then he could do that with me and not, you know, I mean, my free will, why would that be bothered if Paul's wasn't, or if Paul's was bothered, then why would he take away Paul's freedom and all of a sudden make him believe and not do it with me? In fact, I would rather that happen rather than go to hell. Take away my free will. Hallelujah. You know, I mean, if you exist, I mean, yeah, that's what it takes. I mean, because it's going to have to take something like that for me now.
It's not hard to disobey someone, even if you do know they exist. I mean, everyone's had parents, and we knew they existed.
Yeah, you could still, even still if you rebelled. Didn't, I mean, even if you didn't have rationality, I mean, you could still probably disobey something for some other reason, you know.
And the Christian theology actually has it in a situation where Satan is fully aware of the presence of God and then rebels anyway. So it's part of their own theology that you can know God is there, know what he's about, and know that he exists, and still rebel. So free will exists even in the presence and knowledge of God. So why would you have to create this massive epistemic distance to where, you know, I don't know if God's there, so now I can rebel?
Yeah, there's just so many things that just don't make sense. I mean, just so many things. I mean, Satan, you mentioned Satan. Okay, well, you know what? The whole concept is bizarre to the point of absurdity, that there is this creature that God created who knows God's, you know, full power and his love, and yet chose to rebel anyway. Listen, if there's a Satan who knows how powerful the Creator is from the created, and knows also this unlimited love that God supposedly has for him, and also knows that this God has omniscience, that is, you know, he knows my every thought. There's just... anyone who would rebel against that would be suicidal and dumber than a box of rocks. And yet, I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, there's no way in hell I'm going to win this battle. Why? And then why should I rebel? This guy, this dude, he loves me unconditionally. Why would you ever rebel against something like that? It's impossible unless you're pure evil. Now, there's no such thing as a pure evil person. I mean, this person would have to be evil personified. Well, now, if God created this person, then how did this person become that, you know, that pure evil to begin with? It's to the point where he'd be suicidal and think that he could take on God. It's just borderline absurdity to me.
That's all for this time. Tune in tomorrow for the remainder of the interview. Have a blessed day.
This podcast is a production of the Oklahoma Atheist, an organization dedicated to developing a community of like-minded individuals who share the ideas of free and critical thinking, and as opposed to the uncritical acceptance of faith-based ideas and norms. Our activities include dinner meetups, potlucks, family outings, debates, speeches, book clubs, volunteer opportunities, and political events and protests. We welcome all who share the ideals of critical thinking and who reject religious dogma. In addition to cultivating a community, we wish to contribute and put a face with all positive things non-believers and people with a secular viewpoint are doing in the world. If you'd like to know more, please visit us online at www.oklahomaatheist.com.
Perfect.